ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the government's new plan to turbocharge manufacturing and clean energy industries. The Prime Minister calls it a future made in Australia, but will it work? Also, police in New South Wales seize a massive haul of black market medicine. And with 5 days left until Alice Springs youth curfew ends, local leaders are working on ways to tackle disadvantage.
There's got to be long-term strategies, there's got to be long-term thinking. Let the people on the ground decide what they want, what they need, and how can they make their lives so much more fulfilling.
The Prime Minister has declared a change as big as the Industrial Revolution is coming our way, as he unveiled a major plan to supercharge investment in green energy projects and critical industries. Mr Albanese has outlined what he's calling the Future Made in Australia Act, a plan which is being likened to American legislation aiming to ensure the US is a world leader in clean energy manufacturing. While green and business groups are welcoming the government's plan, they're concerned Australia is already well behind in the global race for investment in renewable energy. Gavin Koosh reports.
With the United States, Japan and Europe spending big to spur on new investment, Anthony Albanese warns Australia could be left behind.
We must recognise that the partners we seek are moving to the beat of a new economic reality.
In a speech in Brisbane to unveil his Made in Australia plan, the Prime Minister is offering incentives and subsidies aimed at growing the nation's manufacturing base and gearing it around a cleaner energy system.
This is not old-fashioned protectionism or isolationism. It is the new competition.
The PM is drawing parallels with the US Inflation Reduction Act, which is funneling hundreds of billions of dollars into clean technologies, including solar panels and batteries. And it's exactly the kind of investment drive people like Paul Barrett have been hoping for in Australia. He's the CEO and founder of tech company Hysata, which is developing what's known as hydrogen electrolysers, aimed at providing cheap green energy for big steel and chemical producers.
And so I think that's what Australia can do really well here. And I like the Prime Minister's quote, "We are a future made in Australia." I'm living that every day. I'm setting up a manufacturing facility here in the Wollongong, Australia, a proudly Australian company creating high-tech Australian jobs, exporting to the world and winning.
Paul Barrett points out the US Inflation Reduction Act has already been a massive investment magnet and is pleased the Australian government wants to compete in that space.
And actually not only competing internationally, but winning internationally. And I speak from personal experience. I've lost a company from Australia to the US in the past. And it's just great to hear that there's some policy settings coming in place that can really help support companies like ours. But I think if I looked at today, Australia has a unique opportunity to be a renewable energy powerhouse. We have the raw materials, we have the talent, we have ample renewable, world-class renewable like solar and wind, and we've really got to capture this opportunity.
While unions and environment groups have also thrown their support behind the plan, the opposition has accused the Prime Minister of offering false hope. The Australian Industry Group, which represents thousands of manufacturing firms, wants the government to tread carefully.
So government needs to be a helper, not a handbrake.
Chief Executive Innes Willicks argues governments have a poor track record on industry policy and that being too interventionist could crowd out private investment.
So we want to have an economy where business can flourish, where risks can be taken and jobs can be created. So we need to get the balance right here. Prime Minister's pointed to a lot of the right things. The questions that industry will have out of this is, okay, how are we going to deliver it here? The US Inflation Reduction Act is quite interventionist on one level, and we have to try to calibrate our response that fits the Australian economic circumstance.
Are we playing catch up here given countries like the US and China are adopting similar policies and throwing much more money at them?
Oh, there's no doubt we're playing catch up here. The Americans launched this in August 2022. So we're getting on for close to 2 years since the Inflation Reduction Act came into being, and we've already seen it's had massive effects within the global economy in terms of how capital is allocated and where investment is going for critical industries. So because of that, we have lost investment and jobs that would have otherwise come to Australia.
And Innes Willix cautions it shouldn't be about making everything in Australia.
Now, it doesn't mean we have to make whole batteries, but we can make componentry of batteries. It doesn't mean we have to make everything that we need for the medical industry, but we can make a whole lot of what we need, and COVID exposed us on that front. We have some real strengths, so we need to play to those, but also leave room for serendipity, as you would call it, for things to happen, things to evolve, and for employers and investors to take risk. This is not a certain science. We can't predict the future, but we have to have the adaptability in place to within our economy to allow us to take advantage of circumstances.
Exactly how taxpayers' money will be spent as part of the plan is expected to be unveiled in next month's federal budget and in the lead-up to the next election.
Gavin Koosh reporting. Roy Green is an Emeritus Professor and Special Innovation Advisor at the University of Technology, Sydney. He's advised federal and state governments on science, technology and innovation policy over many years. I asked him which products he believes Australia should be producing.
Well, we haven't really done the work to determine what are the areas in which we can become most proficient. For example, do we make batteries here? Can we become a serious competitor in battery manufacturing when China produces the most and the cheapest? And the answer to that is if we compete in the commodified space where it's all based on low-cost competition, no, we can't. We don't want to get into that. But where it comes to specialist skills, areas of niche competitive advantage, which are supplied by superior R&D, which we can certainly carry out in Australia, we can find a place in battery manufacturing or in the entire value chain, really, from lithium right through to electric vehicles. At the moment, we produce 50% of the world's lithium. We export 90% and we capture only 0.53% of its final value. That is not the future of an advanced economy.
So what role would you like to see the government playing in transforming Australian industry?
I think one of the biggest contributions that the government can make, in which the Prime Minister has signalled, is a whole-of-government approach, a much more coordinated approach to the way we do innovation and industrial policy.
You've advised a lot of governments on that very issue, both at the state and federal level. Where do Australian governments do a poor job of coordinating in that area?
If we look at business support programs, for example, we've counted, it's going to be hard for anyone to believe this, 712 programs when we add up state and Commonwealth level. So how on earth are SMEs going to determine which are the programs that can give them support? We just need a much more coherent, coordinated, inclusive approach across all levels of government and within government. And this goes to the question as well of what kind of programs we can jointly fund between the Commonwealth and the states. One of the things that the Hawke-Keating government did well, and that was our last big period of reform, was develop joint funded programs between the Commonwealth and the states. We don't have programs of that kind, unless we count, for example, one of the Hawke programs that still exists, namely the Industry Capability Network. Everything else is chopped and changed with each new government. Ministers who like to put their names on new programs splice and dice them, and that's something I hope that the government can now address.
Are you at all optimistic on that front, though, given all you've seen? Can these programs be better coordinated and streamlined?
I'm always optimistic, and I think now is the best time because Australians do well, not necessarily at times of prosperity. During, for example, during the commodity boom, when our standard of living went up about 15% in a 6-year period, for us doing nothing except exporting commodities, particularly iron ore, at a higher price. We took no steps to improve our productivity performance. In fact, it deteriorated dramatically behind the sugar hit that we got from the commodity boom. But at times of adversity, we do rise up. And the last time was the Hawke Keating period. And now we have another existential threat, which is climate change.
Professor Green, you mentioned that Australia is quite good at research and development. But how big a problem is it going to be for us to get the workers with the right skills and training to foster these industries?
Yeah, that's a huge issue. And we've seen massive shortages of skills across Australia. They can't all be supplied by immigration. For example, right now we need 50,000 engineers. And out of our universities, we graduate around 13 or 14,000 a year. So there's got to be massive expansion of our education system, but it's going to require investment. It's going to require money. It's going to require a change in the way that we allocate our resources across this economy. If I can give you an example, and this is really the benchmark for how serious a government can become, we provide $7.9 billion a year to something called the diesel fuel tax rebate, which enables a handful of international mining companies to drive around their diesel trucks and have their electricity sometimes produced by diesel engines on their mining sites. Is that really how we want to spend our money? That's three quarters of the entire Commonwealth spend on research and innovation. That's the sort of expenditure that could be switched to skills development, to building up innovation capability and transforming our industries.
That's Emeritus Professor Roy Green from the University of Technology, Sydney. The Senate inquiry into supermarket prices has resumed today, looking into the price-setting practices and market power of the major retailers. The supermarket giant Aldi faced repeated questions on pricing and why it doesn't have any stores in Tasmania, while independent supplier Metcash told the committee the big supermarkets are buying prime sites to stop their smaller competitors from setting up shop. This report from Rima Cheer.
When German supermarket giant Aldi first decided to launch in Australia in 2001, its mission was clear. It wanted to become the country's most affordable supermarket. And over 20 years later, in the midst of a cost of living crisis, politicians like Independent Senator Tammy Tyrrell and Greens Senator Nick McKim want to get stores set up in their state.
Because I am Tasmanian as well, and we do not have Aldi, I need to put that out in the world. I will say that you are a tourist destination for every Tasmanian that comes to the mainland. My family and I went and saw your berry store. Great staff, by the way.
Thanks, Senator Tyrrell, and I can assure you, Ms McGrath, we did not line that up. but I'm sure you've heard loud and clear from both of us how desperate many Tasmanians are to see an Aldi.
The Senate inquiry into supermarket prices held its fourth public hearing today, with Aldi CEO Anna McGrath facing the committee. She says the company is able to keep prices lower than Coles and Woolworths by using a simpler business model.
We've now grown to over 590 stores across Australia, and we operate in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, the ACT, and more recently, South Australia and Western Australia. Our price gap remains between 15 and 20% compared to our competitors.
Aldi owns just under 10.5% of Australia's supermarket share, but there are no plans to expand into Tasmania and other parts of the country where they don't exist yet. Anna McGrath says it's not because Coles and Woolworths are muscling them out of those areas.
Trying to find appropriate distribution centre space or even storage space in certain categories is very difficult. We are a growing business, and therefore we need to make sure that we have distribution and supply chain that can support that. So I would say definitely zoning and then the availability of that industrial commercial facilities.
The committee also heard 97% of Aldi's fresh produce is sourced in Australia, but it wouldn't give a figure on the sourcing of packaged foods like lollies or toiletries. The company says it would support a stronger supermarket code of conduct and greater transparency around pricing, giving customers tools to make better choices. Also appearing at today's hearing was Metcash, Australia's largest supplier to independent supermarkets, including IGA and Foodland franchises. Its CEO Grant Ramage alleges that major retailers are carrying out what's known as land banking to keep the competition out.
An example would be a supermarket in South Australia. Coles offered a significant amount of money over the value that that supermarket would have to another independent. We, through our relationship with the IGA Foodland operator, had a right to step in and match that offer, which we had to do. And I was forced to take action to buy that store and then resell it to another independent because I couldn't be confident that the ACCC would have the visibility and the power to act in time to stop it happening.
In a statement, Coles responded by rejecting allegations of land banking. It says many factors go into its land purchases, including proximity to new communities and growth corridors, and that the supermarket sector in Australia is highly competitive. Coles and Woolworths will front the inquiry at another public hearing on Tuesday.
Rima Chia reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, New South Wales Police seize a huge stash of black market medicine. The bitter political debate over Australia's policy on Palestine is continuing. The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, is accusing the foreign minister, Penny Wong, of doing irreparable damage to our relationship with Israel by raising the possibility of recognising Palestinian statehood. Mr Dutton is also comparing last year's pro-Palestine rally in Sydney to the Port Arthur massacre, arguing the Prime Minister hasn't done enough to stop anti-Semitism in Australia. Stephanie Smail has more.
The Foreign Minister Penny Wong has made clear her view that there won't be long-term peace for Israel until the issue of Palestinian statehood is resolved. But the opposition leader Peter Dutton has accused her and the Prime Minister of being stuck in the past.
I think, frankly, Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese are living out their university prejudices. The views that were created on university campuses for them in the 1980s don't have relevancy in this day and age.
Penny Wong says Hamas can have no role in a successful two-state solution. But Peter Dutton argues the foreign minister has damaged Australia's relationship with Israel, declaring the government has a clear prejudice against the country. And he's again accused the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, of failing to calm anti-Semitic sentiment at home.
He's got a foreign minister who's either freelancing or he supports what she says, but this is the most significant misstep by a foreign minister in our country's recent history. You can't have a foreign minister out there damaging our international relations.
The coalition has consistently voiced support for Israel since the October 7 Hamas attacks, but its criticism of the federal government's handling of the issue has reached a new level since Penny Wong's comments on Palestinian statehood. During a speech at the Sydney Opera House last night, Peter Dutton compared the protests that erupted there after the Hamas attacks to the 1996 Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania. 35 people were killed and 23 others injured in that mass shooting, prompting major gun reform from then Prime Minister John Howard.
Whilst no one was killed during the protests on October 9, thank God, the events at the Sydney Opera House were akin to a Port Arthur moment in terms of their social and national significance. In my judgment, Prime Minister Albanese has not risen to that moment as John Howard did. The problem is that anti-Semitism has found many footholds in our country. The Prime Minister has failed to grasp the gravity of what's happening on our soil.
And he's standing by those comments today. This was the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's take.
Sometimes what Peter Dutton does in his comments is to think about how hard you could possibly go and how angry you could possibly be and then go one step further.
The Prime Minister is firmly backing the Foreign Minister Penny Wong's comments about the potential benefits of an independent Palestinian state.
Well, just more nasty negativity from Peter Dutton, who has nothing positive to offer about domestic politics or about international engagement. A two-state solution is required in the Middle East to break the cycle that has been there for my entire lifetime. I think Australians want to see that.
The question has also been raised about whether it's the right time to be discussing Palestinian statehood, given the deadly Gaza conflict is still raging. Anthony Albanese argues many global leaders are talking about it.
Comments from people like David Cameron, a former British Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, who made similar comments. The comments of President Biden speaking about a two-state solution. Every one of our like-minded partners. I've issued joint statements with the Prime Ministers of Canada and New Zealand, three of the Five Eyes partners, calling for a two-state solution. I've spoken about this consistently for my entire political career.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. That report from Stephanie Smale. Police in New South Wales have seized what they say is the biggest single haul of pharmaceutical drugs in the state's history. 700 kilos of the anti-anxiety medication, commonly known as Xanax, was found in a storage unit in Western Sydney, and the police say it's worth millions of dollars on the black market. Rachel Hayter reports.
Xanax is a drug with fast impact, giving the user an easy way to lighten up.
As it's very quick acting, it kind of gives you this real kind of relaxed, cool feeling.
GP and addiction specialist Dr. Hester Wilson is chair of the specific interest group in addiction with the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners.
When you take it orally, it goes into your stomach, gets absorbed into your system and quickly crosses across what we call a blood brain barrier into the brain.
Xanax is a brand name for alprazolam, a prescription-only drug that belongs to the benzodiazepine or benzo family, a class of minor tranquilizers. Because of the way it slows down activity in your brain and nervous system, it's sometimes used to treat insomnia or anxiety. But it's those sedating effects that also make it commercially viable on the black market.
It's very marketable on the black market. And we hear people paying $15 to $20 to $30 for a tablet, for a 2 milligram tablet. So that is potentially a huge amount of money.
New South Wales police say they've seized 722 kilograms of alprazolam from a storage unit in Auburn in Western Sydney. They're calling it the largest single seizure of pharmaceutical drugs in the state's history, with a street value of $12 million.
Because of its quick onset offset, it's more addiction forming. So it's more attractive, you know, and if you use it, your body and your brain go, oh, that was really great, I want more.
The Pennington Institute is a drug harm reduction organisation which publishes an annual overdose report. Its CEO is John Ryan.
Xanax and the benzodiazepine class more broadly has increased in the last 20 years, and it's now implicated in about a third of all overdose deaths in Australia.
Because coroner's investigations take time, their most recent report looks at 2021.
In the last year where we've got the finalised data, there were 544 benzodiazepine-related overdose deaths. And that's unintentional drug-induced deaths.
Janet Shaw is the manager of Reconnexion, Australia's only specialist benzodiazepine addiction service. Its main client group is people who've been prescribed benzos by their general practitioner to treat insomnia or anxiety.
It's dependence that's come about from people just like you and me who've gone to the doctor and they've been given a prescription to deal with that issue, and then they have found down the track that they've become dependent.
And once you're hooked, benzodiazepines are notoriously hard to come off.
A lot of authorities actually think of it as the hardest of all, harder than ice, harder than heroin. And if someone has been taking benzos continually for many years, and we've got clients who've been taking them as prescribed by their doctor, 20 years, 30 years, even up to 50 years, and it can take literally years for them to withdraw. The withdrawal symptoms for benzodiazepines include anything that can go wrong with your body: aches and pains, hypersensitivity to light, to touch, disorientation, stomach cramps, suicidal ideation.
Janet Shaw explains the patients taking bootlegged benzos are harder to treat.
Some of the black market drugs are extremely potent. They're of a very high potency, and people don't realise they might take one tablet thinking, I used to take one tablet of Valium or something, and taking one tablet might be 20 or even 100 times more potent than what they were used to taking. It's very difficult to work with them because of that really uncertain dosage they've been on, and also because we need to have them prescribed legitimate medications while they're coming off.
ReConnection's Victorian government funding is set to end in June, and manager Janet Shaw wants the Australian government to step in.
This work should be funded by the federal government because it's a national health issue. There is a major gap if we're not here. We get calls all the time from people interstate and they say, isn't there a ReConnection in our state? And we have to tell them that there isn't.
ReConnection says without a bailout this year, it'll no longer be able to help two-thirds of benzodiazepine-addicted clients.
Rachel Hayter reporting. The duration of the Alice Springs youth curfew is extended this week until next Tuesday. The government declaration means anyone under 18 can't be in the CBD at night without good reason. The curfew's supporters acknowledge such a measure isn't a long-term solution to the town's crime problems. And as Thomas Morgan reports, local leaders have a range of opinions on what should happen next.
From the moment the Northern Territory announced a youth curfew in Alice Springs just over 2 weeks ago, the clock was ticking on efforts to figure out what should happen next.
There's got to be long-term strategies, there's got to be long-term thinking, and there's got to be a lot of home truths that come home to rest.
William Tilmouth is an Arunda man and the chair of non-profit organisation Children's Ground. The curfew, which bans anyone under 18 from the town's CBD without a valid reason, will end on Tuesday. The NT Police Commissioner says there's been a noticeable reduction in crime so far. William Tilmouth says the focus now needs to be on empowering people rather than just stopping criminal activity.
Well, start empowering the most disadvantaged, the most underprivileged, the most people who don't have opportunity. Start empowering them. Let the people on the ground decide what they want, what they need, and how can they make their lives so much more fulfilling.
Donna Archie is the chief executive of the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress. She says the curfew has worked, but the deployment of police auxiliary liquor inspectors, or PALIs, to every bottle shop in the Alice has made the biggest difference.
The government needs to make sure that the PALIs are 100% coverage going forward, because as soon as you do not have 100% coverage, we see the antisocial behaviour and alcohol-related calm automatically increase.
She says the government already has powers in place to prevent repeat offending once the curfew ends. That includes responsibility agreements that could see families cut off from welfare payments if they're failing to prevent their children from breaking the law.
What we are advocating for is for those families that are not taking care of their children, and they have been provided opportunity for the necessary supports, that their welfare payments are quarantined at the level of 80 to 100%. People are wanting to see what are the consequences on families that aren't sort of looking after their kids.
Advocates also say the transient nature of Alice Springs' population creates a unique challenge. Blair McFarland is the Northern Territory's Australian of the Year.
The thing you've got to understand about Alice, it does not exist in isolation. It's a centre of 250 Aboriginal communities around it that sort of use it as a centre. They bring their kids, and the kids are homeless when they're in here and they're hungry.
A Territory report from 2019 found a weekly shop cost 56% more in remote communities compared to the major centres. So residents end up in the Alice because they can't afford to live at home. Blair McFarland says the government needs to bring down the cost of basics.
That's a driver for not only people breaking in to steal food, and when the ultimate deterrent for those people is getting put in a jail where they get three meals a day and a safe place to sort of sleep for the first time in their life maybe, we're not looking at a win scenario for the usual punitive engagements.
It's not the only idea being raised to encourage people to stay in their remote communities where they have housing and family support. Scott McConnell is a long-time Alice Springs resident and former NT Labor politician.
A lot of these people are refugees in their own country.
They're living here in Alice Springs because they can't access the services, including a participatory economy, that they want in their home community.
One of the services being suggested is bilingual education. Many schools in remote communities hold classes in English, which is not the language spoken at home. Scott McConnell says schools are the key to improving outcomes for those on country.
If we increase school attendance, people will have more opportunity to work. They'll have more opportunity to manage their own lives. This is a really important thing we need to do. Let's worry about school attendance instead of the crime statistics.
The curfew in Alice Springs ends on Tuesday.
That report from Thomas Morgan and Angus Randall. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, music festivals have been a big deal, attracting millions of revelers. But the appeal seems to be dying away, with a string of cancellations this year. Today, Double J's national music correspondent, Zan Rowe, on whether the big music festival can be saved. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.